Hello, this is Christopher Holmes, and this is another zero-point teaching seminar. And I have on the telephone here, in the background, James Moffat. Jim, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Okay.
Good.
Welcome, listeners, and I refer you to my website. It's at www.zeropoint.com. Spelt out in letters, .ca. And I invite you to view my site, and I have quite a wide selection of my writings up there. Writings on the Blavatsky, Gurdjieff, mysticism and science, the issues of intelligent design, and quite an assortment of articles I've written on everything from the Dalai Lama to the Canadian musical band Tea Party to critique of what the Bleep movie, and quite a variety of materials up on my website. So I hope the listener will have a look and visit Zero Point, and hopefully order some books. I have a very unique series of books, the Within Without from Zero Point series, which present a model of human consciousness which is really quite substantially different from anything that I know of in the existing literature. Not that it is a unique model of consciousness. In fact, it's based on the esoteric teachings, on the study of Kabbalah and Judaism and Christianity and Blavatsky. So it's a model of consciousness drawing from the esoteric teachings of mystical and religious teachings. And my work, the focus here is on trying to understand the heart doctrine, the view that the origins of human consciousness really have to do with the human heart. And I maintain that consciousness in the body is connected to blood flow, and that consciousness can be experienced through the whole body as well as within the subtle bodies. So this contrasts quite dramatically with the Western view in modern science and even in New Age teachings, which all elaborate the heart, the head doctrine, the belief, I would call it a belief, that the brain produces consciousness. And as I repeatedly point out, this hasn't been proven by science. In fact, no one can define or explain what consciousness is, yet alone where it's produced in the brain. And in fact, all the neurologists and neuroscientists examining the brain, no one's been able to identify what the neural correlates of consciousness are and how or where it's produced in the brain. And so the idea that consciousness is connected to the heart and the blood flow is a very original and alternative perspective on this most profound issue of modern science, which is the enigmas and mysteries of human consciousness. I would say that really is the number one unsolved enigma in the sciences today. And our understanding of reality and the world will never be complete until we address this most fundamental issue, the nature and origin of human consciousness. And connected to this, which is so important, is whether or not there is continued consciousness and existence past the experience of death. Is there life on the other side? And I would maintain that there is definitely life on the other side within different subtle bodies and different dimensions. In fact, the persistence of consciousness beyond death, then if we could establish that, then that, by implication, suggests that the head doctrine, the idea the brain produces consciousness, is completely erroneous, if consciousness, in fact, can exist apart from the material body, mind, or body and brain completely. So in the zero-point teachings, I'm looking at the nature of consciousness and the idea of it being connected to the heart. And we also explore various ideas in quantum physics and trying to understand the physics of the heart. So I maintain that there is actually a higher dimensional physics and metaphysics to the human heart. Now, the concepts elaborated in the Within Without from Zero Point series are very complex and take time to understand and appreciate the arguments being presented. And that's what we try to do in our bi-monthly. Every 2 weeks, we have this radio spot. So in addition to the issues of consciousness, we talk about the issues of creation, and we compare mystical views of creation with modern scientific viewpoints. And the main thrust of the argument is that modern scientific views of creation have actually been anticipated by mystics by several hundreds or thousands of years. This includes the idea of what's called vacuum genesis in science, that before creation existed, everything was absorbed into what is seemingly a void or emptiness of the quantum vacuum, but the quantum vacuum is really a plenum. It's infinitely rich in potential and energy, and it's all, but in a latent form. So we see this paradox in physics, that the vacuum, the seeming void, is also the plenum or plenum, containing the abundance of energies and potencies. And also the mystics anticipated the concept of the point source origination of the universe. Blavatsky described this in 1888. She said, material points without extension, or zero points, are the materials by which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies. So this suggests that all living beings actually have a zero-point center. And it is through this zero-point center that higher dimensional forces well up within a human being. They manifest from within without, from zero points. Hence the title of the book series, Within Without from Zero Points. So I'm suggesting that each human being has a zero-point center, and this is associated with the heart, and it's associated with the physics of the heart. Now, modern science has discussion recently about zero-point fields. The new ideas in physics suggest that the space, instead of being empty, there's really an abundance of energy and potency within space itself, and that we exist within space. And the zero point fields. Space is full of all these zero-point fields, and if you add up the energy of all the zero-point fields latent in the vacuum, you find a huge amount of energy latent within any cubic centimeter of space. So I'm actually saying that a human being, we ourselves, come out of the nothingness. A Sufi sage says this. He says, not since God brought man out of nothingness has he ceased to be a traveler. So the idea is that we ourselves come out of the nothingness. And I would say the emergence of human consciousness within a living human being is analogous to the creation of the universe. That consciousness emerges from a point source, and it expands within and without, and it spreads all through the body. And as a person approaches death, the energies of consciousness and vitality gather again at the heart as the soul leaves the body. So I'm suggesting there's this whole deep physics and metaphysics to the human heart. And the ideas supporting this are found throughout the mystical literature. For instance, in yoga, we find within the heart, first they describe there being a jiva atma. A jiva atma is like the individual self. We might think of the jiva atma as an I, like where we say I. It is our singular I, the jiva atma. It's a spiritual spark or a divine source emanation. The jiva atma is said to be of the same substance as a paramatma. A paramatma is the infinite super soul.
Whereas the infinite supersoul is infinite, the jiva atma is like a spark of that infinite supersoul. But the jiva atma is described as infinitesimal. So again, it's like a zero-point source. It's an element so small, it disappears from view as judged from a material perspective. And then in yoga, it's described that the jiva atma then is established within what is called the bliss sheath in the heart. And the bliss sheath is described as approximately the size of a small grape. And it is described as a mass of unemergent light. Okay, so instead of light that radiates off and radiates away, it's a mass of light that is a body of light that is contained within space, and that this mass of unemergent light underlies the physical processes of the heart. So I'm actually saying we need to take these ideas from yoga and other esoteric traditions and try to look at them scientifically, and that if we draw analogies or if we look to modern physics, we can actually see how these mystical concepts actually correspond to modern notions in physics about the nature of the quantum vacuum, about singularity creation, about higher dimensional space. So we're trying to develop an alternative model of the physics of the heart and of human consciousness. Okay. So, Jim, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine.
Okay. Anything you'd like to just... I offered a few brief introductory comments.
Yeah, I was just listening... when I was listening to this, I was just kind of thinking a little bit about what I've been reading lately in terms of scientists such as Carl Sagan and Richard Dawkins writing about God and science versus religion. And one of the things that you were talking about is kind of describing how if you take the esoteric idea as above, so below, or that the microcosm, that man is a microcosm of the macrocosm, you realize that just in some of these things that you've just been describing is that the same principles and dynamics apply on all these different levels. So you have a very different understanding of how it's possible to say that man is made in God's image. Now, that doesn't mean, like, literally that man is made in God's image, like Gurdjieff says. It doesn't mean that that means that we both carry our combs in our front pockets, you know, but rather that the same principles and laws apply on different levels between man and the universe. And this leads to such a profound understanding of, you know, what seems like a fairly straightforward statement, it has these profound truths underlying it.
The idea of the microcosm and the macrocosm.
And in turn, you know, when scientists like materialists like Sagan and Dawkins respond to an esoteric maxim like that or a piece of scripture, they take it literally. You know, they think it's because, oh, that means that we both carry our comb in our front pocket, so we're made in God's image. But, I mean, it's such a ridiculously uninformed and unintelligent interpretation of something that's quite profound. So when I was listening to you talk about these things, I realized, you know, well, that's the other side of it, that's the more intelligent side of it, is that you have to really study these things to understand what's actually behind them, and that they're very profound truths contained within these apparently simple sayings or maxims.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, as you've mentioned before, it's like people like Sagan and Dawkins, like when they discuss the God hypothesis, they have such a juvenile view, as you were saying, of God. Like, what is God? What they think a person who believes in religion believes in God, who kind of sits on a throne, and he's a man. And it's such an anthropomorphic and patriarchal view of what God is. And they don't at all address the subtle and complex ideas in religious teachings about what the nature of God really is.
Yeah, and as they say, it's kind of a straw man that, well, it's not kind of, it is a straw man that they set up to shred and debunk, and really, I was reading a review of Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, which appeared in the review was in the New York Review of Books, and the guy says that really, you know, and this guy's an admirer of some of his earlier science writing, but he says really when it comes to discussing the topic of religion and God, Dawkins doesn't really have much to offer because, you know, you could get much more complicated and interesting discussions of theology from anybody who really knew anything about the history of religion and theology, and that really all he's doing is trying to kind of shotgun approach to anything that casts a bad light on religion. He seems to think refutes it, but he doesn't really discuss any of the substance of it, and doesn't really discuss any of the really profound ideas that are involved in religion. I mean, in Carl Sagan's book that just came out, which The Varieties of Scientific Experience, that was his lectures he presented in 1985 in Scotland, the Gifford Lectures on Natural Theology, and he talks about the universe being, according to scripture, being 6,000 years old. I think that was, you know, Bishop Usher that calculated from the Bible that the universe is supposed to be 6,000 years old. But other than there are people that believe that, but I mean they're wrong. And I think most religious people don't really subscribe to that, you know, really simplistic kind of fundamentalist idea. There's so much more variety of serious thinking about religion, and yet that's what he chooses to, you know, say. And he says that, well, this is Sagan says, it seems to me that the stories that religion tells are too provincial, too local. And then I'm thinking, well, if he read the material that in your books and that material in esotericism, the variety of stories that from esoteric and mystical teachings, it's anything but provincial or local. I mean, I think it inspires exactly the same kind of awe and wonder that he talks about science inspiring. So it's really, they're not very informed or enlightened discussions of the God hypothesis, and it really, you know, because they're scientists and because they're accomplished in one area, it doesn't really mean that they have any particular insight or anything really important to say about these topics, I would say.
Generally, I find that the whole debate between science and religion is generally posed highly simplistically. No one ever realizes that religion actually poses hypotheses that can be verified or analyzed or tested scientifically. Like, for instance, I say that, in a way, religion espouses the heart doctrine, that's implicit and evident in esoteric religious teachings. So that's an actual model of consciousness connected to the heart, and we're ensouled through the breath. Like, it's not just saying, oh, we have a soul and we believe in God. No, if you go into esoteric religious teachings, there's much more concrete ideas about creation processes, and it provides a model of the nature of creation, and a model that's even capable of being, I think, tested and evaluated with respect to the facts of science. But in the whole debate on science and religion, I see generally it's religious people trying to say science isn't complete and there are unsolved gaps in scientific theory, or that it couldn't have happened by chance. But there's never any substantive issues discussed. People don't have that grasp of how to address that debate.
Yeah, and I'd agree. And when you read more people who are more familiar with the esoteric tradition, especially, I was thinking of like somebody like Jacob Needleman or somebody like Theodore Roszak, and you read their discussions, it's on such a different level. You know, it's so much more insightful and so much much more richer. But as you say, like, I mean, well, there are a couple of things. One is, I think a lot of the books written in English tend to be really, they're just really reacting to the Judeo-Christian tradition, and especially to the Bible. And I would say in Sagan's work, especially to the Old Testament, he rarely, in my reading, I can't really find it much reference to the New Testament, which I, you know, can be interpreted on a whole different level too, in terms of esoteric teachings. But the other aspect of it is that, as you say, is that even in that limited scope of the debate, like, I mean, there are so many more, you know, holy books and so many more different sources of scripture and religious teachings. But even in that limited debate, it's always very, what Gurdjieff would say, formatory. It's very mechanical thinking. There's this science and then there's that religion. And
yeah.
And it's everything's posed in terms of these simple dichotomies. It's either this or it's either that. And there's no, and that's where I believe that the mystical and esoteric perspective brings a third force in which you see the limits of materialist science and the limits of what I would say established religion, conventional religion, that both of them are kind of limited in their understanding of what's actually said.
Yeah, equally superficial.
Yeah, exactly.
Really, yeah. At least from a scientific viewpoint, like a religious person may just believe in God, but acknowledge that's based on belief.
Yeah.
Yeah, but even religious people aren't familiar with the scientific ideas and hypotheses within their own religion. Like I don't think I've ever met a Christian or who kind of understands the first chapter of the Book of Genesis, how that relates to modern science. Like no one even considers that that might be, even if it's expressed allegorically, there's things in the first book of Genesis, I would say, that are pertinent to modern creation physics. But people aren't even familiar with that.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that applies to a variety of things. I mean, that's another aspect of the epistemology, too, involved in religious teaching, is that much of what's in Scripture is indirect teaching. It's teaching by myth and by parable and by allegory, and that doesn't require literal thinking. That's to evoke different feelings, different states of consciousness, which go beyond normal sense-based thinking. And so sometimes there are truths that are revealed through Scripture, which are not necessarily evident to the literal mind. At the same time,
yeah,
as you say, there are ideas contained in things that if you read them in a non-literal way, they're totally pertinent and do have something very important to say to us about, which is, I agree with you, I believe is not only applicable to science, modern science, but, you know, is testable and it gives hints as to things that should be examined, points out things that can be examined. I mean, and then there's the whole, there's the whole idea of, you know, even something as basic as the law of three as it appears in various scriptures. I mean, you could say, you can look at the Holy Trinity in the Bible and say, well, that's an interesting image, but there's so much truth contained in it. There's so much knowledge contained in that simple image.
Of the law of three, yeah.
Yeah, it refers to so much more, and then it's in all these other different religious traditions, where there's the three Zazahat in Judaism and Kabbalah, or the three Gunas in Hinduism. I mean, it's throughout religious teachings, and it's not an accident. It's there. It's saying something quite profound.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the three gunas in the Vedic teachings, that concept is so invaluable. And those are, they say that anything manifested in creation is a combination of the three gunas, which are called sattva, rajas, and tamas, which represent intelligence, energy, and matter. So you have that triunity in the Vedic teachings, and then you look at modern science, and you see historically, Western science has always worked only with the duality of matter and energy. And it's only in the newest physics emerging now that they recognize information and intelligence as latent within space and as third force. Like Michael Talbot in the Holographic Universe book, he talks about how now information is third force in modern science. So in a way, I would say that's exactly consistent with what is stated in the teaching of the three gunas, just as one example. So people think, oh, it's just the idea that, oh, that just it's God is has a triune nature. Well, it's not simply that. The law of three is suggesting everything in creation has to be understood as a manifestation of three aspects as a unity. But that's just one example. I was thinking another example from the book of Genesis is, it's interesting, in the beginning the earth was empty and void and darkness was upon the face of the deep. That sounds to me like a pretty good description of vacuum Genesis, that there was a period where there was this empty and void, like no manifestation. So even in the first verses of Genesis, is the idea of vacuum Genesis is quite consistent with the book of Genesis. And another thing that struck me is reading Swami Prabhupada the other day talking about Vedic teachings. He says, the Vedas are a science of God consciousness. So, and he says it's the most advanced science there is.
Yeah.
So really, and he explains in one point, he says, in modern times, we support all departments of education and science except the most important area, which is the science of God consciousness. And that is what religious teachings attempt to explicate.
Yeah, it was interesting when you're talking about how useful the idea of the gunas is in applying it to modern science, and as you say now, it's not just matter and energy. It's you realize that there's been a realization within modern physics that really somehow you have to account for intelligence, that it's the third force or information, whatever you call it. But isn't it interesting that really the whole of Western physics in the last 500 years was aimed at removing spirit and animism from the universe and
yeah.
trying to explain the universe in terms solely in material terms without any kind of life principle or any kind of spiritual principle or with any kind of animistic principle. It was a concerted effort to remove it, and yet in the last 100 years, really, all the discoveries of physics have kind of pointed to the intellectual conclusion that you have to recognize whatever you want to call it, mind, information, intelligence. Really, it's spirit. You could say it's spirit in another guise and dressed up to make it a little more palatable to scientists. But that's the bottom line, is that really materialism, the limits of materialism have been exposed, and there is something else beyond materialism. There's something beyond matter and energy. And it's like, if matter and energy are kind of complementary aspects of the same thing, well, then the model of the gunas seems even that much more applicable, because it's intelligence, matter, and energy. The threefold is really the more complete picture of what underlies everything.
That's also very interesting, like, even how Gurdjieff particularly describes the law of three. He says that two of the forces are as opposing forces and are more easily discerned. That's why we always see the two things.
Right.
But he says we are third force blind, and that the third force is latent within the medium. So the medium is actually within space itself. So this is suggesting what he's saying is third force is this intelligence or information latent within space itself. And so then when we come to John Wheeler, the physicist, he says at one point, it comes from bit. And he means it is a material energetic system, comes from bit, meaning information. That there are fields of information underlying the transformations of matter and energy within time and space. So the mystics are not only saying that there's three principles operative within any phenomena, but that third force is kind of latent within the medium of space itself. So again, it's not just saying there's intelligence, but also giving us a deeper model of how that's related to the nature of space.
Yeah, and you know, the other another aspect of the law of three from a Gurdjieff perspective, which I found for myself, I found very interesting, was, you know, he says that we're third force blind, like in our normal state of consciousness, we're third force blind because, you know, we can't recognize that we see this and that, we see the duality or the dichotomies that are really inherent properties of our normal waking consciousness. But as you begin to become more conscious, and if you try to become more aware, then you introduce a third force into things, and which neutralizes the opposition between the two forces that seem out there. So it's a recognition of the third force transforms the meaning of everything. And I mean, for me, like trying to understand the law of three on a cosmological level, I mean, I could read about it, but I couldn't really, you know, say one way or another whether it was true. But I began to understand that in myself psychologically. I began to see, oh, okay, yeah. Normally, I see things in terms of these dualities, in terms of these dichotomies, which seem like, you know, a complete explanation of things. But if my consciousness or my awareness changes, if my emotional presence changes, and I begin to see how I impose meaning on things, or how my ego is involved in this, then I can see there is a third force, which is the knower, and that the knower is variable. And so to begin to become conscious is to introduce the third force into everything, and changes the meaning of everything, and overcomes the illusion of duality.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I think another example of that that's so illustrative is if you look at modern psychology, and every modern textbook of psychology defines it as the science of behavior and the mind in a simple dualistic way. So that we have the mind, which we think is in the head, and it we think controls the body. So you have the mind and the body. And there, in a way, the mind is intelligence and the body is the material nature, but there, the modern psychology has no heart or soul. Whereas mystical teachings, they suggest, like Gurdjieff describes us as three-brained beings. We function mentally, emotionally, and physically. And even each of those centers is in a different story. The head is in the upper story, in the brain. I mean, in the head. And then the head, heart, and hands. It's like there's a threefoldness. And modern psychologists haven't even got that right. They don't. It's just a body and brain. But they don't consider head, heart, and hands. No one thinks there's a psychology of the heart and soul. So that's another really important example of this triune analysis and how it compares with the dualistic thinking of modern times.
Yeah, well, as you've said in your writings, when you begin to look at modern psychology, it's rife with all these dualities and dichotomies. You know, there's the left brain and the right brain, and there's divergent and convergent thinking, and almost every kind of new theoretical advance always involves some sort of this and that. You know, there's always one thing and the other.
Yeah, new duality of the mind, or lateral thinking, or what's the other one? What's that? Do you know lateral thinking and divergent thinking?
Parallel and lateral. I don't know, parallel.
Conscious, unconscious.
Parallel and linear, I think, is but I mean, well, that's the other thing too, is that when you really start thinking at it, like rational can be juxtaposed with a variety of different rational versus emotional, rational versus intuitive. You know, I mean, even the dichotomies, some of the same elements are linked with a variety of other things. You know, and it gets very confusing after a while. But,
yeah.
But the bottom line is that people don't really kind of recognize that the need to go beyond that, you know, that obvious what seems obvious, that thinking and to see the third force, I think that's an incredibly valuable tool to have to judge things, to understand things, is to try to see how dualities are imposed on things and how there might be a third force, and to understand how that might work is just incredibly valuable. And,
yeah.
And you know, as we were talking before about in previous programs about consciousness, and now that psychologists actually admit that that consciousness exists, what an incredible advance that is. There is a book out by Susan Blackmore, who's a British psychologist, called Conversations on Consciousness, and she talks to all of the almost all of the leading theorists on consciousness, from psychology and neurobiology and philosophy, and when I was reading this book, the thing that struck me that more than anything else was almost every person in that book, with a couple of exceptions, notable exceptions, talks about consciousness strictly in terms of the brain's processes and activities and structures, and doesn't even kind of relate it to anything other than the brain. Like the image I got reading about their discussions of consciousness is that we're just these heads that are ambulatory heads, you know, like there's not any discussion of the body, there's no discussion of anything below the neck.
Even consciousness in the body.
Yeah,
it's assumed that all the consciousness of the body is all up in the head.
All up in the head, and of course, you know, the brain is the master organ, so everything is mediated by the brain. But they don't even kind of go beyond that to say, well, you know, there are hormonal processes, there's blood circulation, I mean, there are major nerve plexuses in the abdomen, the cardiac and the gastrointestinal plexus. I mean, there are all these different, you know, there's a spinal cord. I mean, these are all aspects of what make up a human being, and yet these things are all kind of just, and again, I think it reinforces this idea that there's the mind and the body. You know,
yeah.
Like we're sort of these ambulatory thinking brains, you know. I mean, that's the other thing, too, is almost all of the discussion is about the brain's thinking operation, and
yeah,
that's pretty much it. You know, it's like we don't have emotions, or we don't have physical sensations, and we, you know, physical experiences. It's this very peculiarly attenuated image of what consciousness could be and where it could be. You know, so nobody kind of looks for it anywhere other than the brain, and nobody thinks about it in any terms other than thinking.
Yeah, and cognition.
Cognition and basic mental processes, you know, perceptual processes are especially, you know, favorite because they're easier to study, you know. But there's, and of course, the other idea is that there's no kind of discussion of how consciousness might be understood by studying it within yourself, and how it might be understood if you actually attempted to change it, you know. Like there's no recognition of that possibility, and yet from the esoteric perspective, in terms of systematic self-study, is the whole key to understanding consciousness, and that's throughout the esoteric teachings. That's what esoteric teachings involve.
Yeah, that's very interesting. The other day, a friend gave me a copy of Down the Rabbit Hole, you know, which is a part two of What the Bleep Do We Know?
Oh, okay, yeah.
And I've got this, like, three-disc volume set on Down the Rabbit Hole. And all these interviews with all these consciousness theorists and so on, and every one of them simply assumes consciousness is only in the mind. All of them.
Yeah.
You know, I was shocked. There's no mention of the heart in the whole movie. And the discussions of consciousness, no one has even that basic idea that you have to study consciousness in yourself, that you can never observe consciousness as an external phenomena. So the only way to approach it is within the inner world through self-study. Psychologists haven't even grasped that concept.
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary. I was reading this piece by Jacob Needleman, who is quite familiar with and is a very good writer about esoteric ideas, and he says there's been this complete failure to recognize that, first of all, to recognize that self-study, systematic self-study, is something that's worthwhile, but also that it's something that requires considerable skill and a very sophisticated method to employ it. You know, you can't just sort of study yourself willy-nilly, observing yourself. I mean it's like scientific training in the sense that it requires study. You have to study how to study, and you have to study a system to implement it, and then you need guidance in terms of correctly organizing your observations and making sense of them. And that whole idea is completely absent in modern psychology, I would say is probably the greatest failing of modern psychology. If psychologists want to be good scientists and they want to study consciousness by observing things that empirically, but really self-study is empirical, I would argue, because you're studying things and you're making observations and you're categorizing them and you're organizing them, and you can study yourself, your inner world, as you can study the external world. And I think that's a notion that just doesn't really jive with modern scientific thought, with modern psychological thought, but that's science and psychology's great loss, is that they haven't recognized that you can study yourself systematically and that there is a science of the mind. But it doesn't mean have to involve looking at cells through microscopes or performing sophisticated magnetic image resonancing with the brain or any of these incredible tools that we have now. I mean, those are all valuable, but that's not the most valuable method for studying consciousness.
Yeah, it's funny, too, because, like, one of the ways modern psychologists try to identify what parts of the brain consciousness is in is they, for instance, give someone different type of, say, arithmetic task, and then they monitor what part of the brain is used to solve those mathematical tasks. But the way they actually monitor brain activity is through monitoring the blood flow.
Yeah.
So, which is what I would say is exactly that the consciousness is connected to the blood flow. So even when they're trying to say that, these different neural networks are creating consciousness, they're actually monitoring not neural activity but blood flow. Then they don't see the blood flow, they see that they only assume it's secondary to consciousness.
Of course, given that, you would think that they would sort of be interested that blood does flow through the rest of the body. It doesn't stop just at the neck,
if you map the whole living being through magnetic resonance and watch the blood flow through the whole human being. That's how I say you could attempt to map consciousness and how consciousness is centered in someone.
Yeah, and we talked about this before, but on a very simplistic level, I mean, anybody can perform these observations, perform experiments on themselves. I mean, if you concentrate on your left foot and trying to warm it, you can feel your foot getting warmer. I mean, it's possible to do that. It's because you're increasing the blood flow. If you're sexually aroused, your organs, your sexual organs, have increased blood flow. I mean, it's so simple, If you sleep on your arm and you cut off the blood flow, you can't feel your arm. It disappears,
Yeah, you lose consciousness.
You lose consciousness
of
it. I mean, it's so obvious. I mean, and yet, and that may seem like trivial examples, but that's not trivial. That's incredibly important, as you say. You know, why would you not take that into consideration? If you're going to measure blood flow in the brain, when people are to see, what areas are involved in performing various functions and tasks, then it's quite logical to, why wouldn't you think about blood throughout the rest of the body, And then, of course, you get into all sorts of blood-borne substances which perform, all sorts of different functions in maintaining the vitality of the body and in maintaining the consciousness of an individual's consciousness. I mean, it's incredibly complex, but you have to get out of our heads and into our entire bodies to really understand it. And then, of course, if you get out of your head and start to realize the importance of the heart, then there's a whole other, huge area there where that remains unexplored, other than for a few people. And I, as you say, it's amazing nobody ever talks about it, because in your work, in the Heart Doctrine, you cite all these different esoteric sources, and over again, they talk about consciousness in the heart. I mean, it's not one, it's not two, it's not five, it's not ten. It's repeated in such beautiful descriptions and such elegant descriptions that it's amazing that people don't recognize this. I mean,
it's shocking. No one's considered it seriously because they say, oh, the idea of consciousness in the heart, that sounds nice, like it's... that's nice, but that's just fanciful, or it's just a religious belief. They don't consider, consider this seriously as a scientific idea.
Yeah.
Another thing that strikes me, like just staying with this topic, is how, going back to what you mentioned a moment ago, it's not only in the brain that we have neurological activity. As you were saying, we have the central nervous system, so there's all the neurology of the spinal cord, and then there's the whole neurology of the autonomic nervous system, which is it's primarily outside of the brain.
Yeah.
And the main tracks run parallel to the spinal cord, and you have all these major nerve plexi, like the solar plexus in your stomach. Now, if people feel anxious or worried, you feel it in your stomach, in your solar plexus. Now, you can have that as a direct experience. Now, where on your sensory motor strip is your solar plexus represented? It's not. It's not on the sensory motor strip, but we have direct experiences of the solar plexus, which suggests that that consciousness actually is in the area of the solar plexus. Like, we're not aware of our solar plexus in our heads. We're aware of our solar plexus in our solar plexus. So we have this whole complex autonomic nervous system, and no one's ever showed why neurons in the head might produce consciousness, but not neurons in the autonomic nervous system, or not neurons outside of the brain. Yeah, and then we come to the fact that the heart has its own electromagnetic system, completely independently of the head brain. In fact, the heart begins to beat well before the neural system is developed. And myelination of the brain, the neural tracts. So, and the electromagnetic system of the heart, as Pearsall estimates, it has 5,000 times the electromagnetic volume than the brain has. So if we looked at a human being as an electromagnetic quantum system, the heart would clearly be regarded as the center of that quantum system, not the brain. So scientists have never provided any proof as to why it's only neurological activity in the head that is considered to produce consciousness. In a way, I think what is claimed to be a scientific idea really is pseudoscientific. It's simply assumption, but it's presented as if it's truth.
Yeah. I think I'm pretty sure of this. Aren't there considerably more neurons in the nerve plexus of the abdomen, like the gastro and the cardiac plexus? Aren't there more neurons there than there actually are in the brain?
Actually, I'm not sure.
I think there are. I think
I'm
I read
sure.
that. But you know, that Pearsall statement about the electromagnetic field around the heart being, you know, so much larger is incredible. I mean, I think of this in terms of the fourth wave model, Gurdjieff's teaching about, you know, that we can consider people in their normal consciousness to have three centers of intelligence, or brains, three different brains, and one is is the head brain, and that governs intellectual and mental functions, and then one is the emotional center, which is centered in the nerve plexus of the cardiac plexus and the gastric plexus, and then the third brain is in the spinal column, and when you start to think And so that governs like moving and instinctual functioning. And so when you start to realize that who we are, what our consciousness and awareness consists of, you know, Gurdjieff says that we function mentally, emotionally, and physically, which is really a combination of our moving, instinctual, and sexual functions, but taken physically. And then he says, you know, we don't understand, because we're not properly conscious, we don't understand that our experience is the interaction of our thoughts and our feelings and our physical states, and we don't understand how they influence one another, how they result from one another, how they're in constant interaction and connection. And, you know, that's what I, when I was talking earlier about how I was struck by these consciousness researchers, they just talk about the brain, and they talk about a very small aspect, in my estimation, of the mind, basically about perception and thinking and basic mental functioning. But what you, we're sitting here talking, I mean, you know, I have a physical body and you have a physical body, and we have emotional concerns and identifications which interact with our thoughts and with our physical states. And it's such a much more complex and interesting way to look at consciousness to realize this. But it also, it restores consciousness to the whole person. And I would say that, you know, one of the reasons why people do study consciousness only in the brain and they ignore the heart is that that's been the result of what's happened in science in the last 500 years, that consciousness, just as all those things of like consciousness and spirit and animism and purpose and every kind of ethereal quality has been removed from the universe out there. Well, I'd say consciousness has been withdrawn from the universe and ensconced in the cranium, in the cerebral cortex. And it's like psychologists trying to be good little scientists want to look for only there. But it's like the drunk trying to look for his keys on the front porch where there's light, because there's more light there, and the keys aren't there, you know.
He lost his keys somewhere else.
They're lost. They're in the darkness, but, you know, he wants to look because there's more light there. And, I mean, as I say, everybody knows, you know, you're nowhere without a brain, but try getting around without a heart, you know, or a spinal column. You know? In a sense, it's counterintuitive to look beyond it. To look beyond the brain, but it isn't, because in a sense it's counterintuitive to look at the brain. It's like your little pointing game, you know, about who am I? I mean, people have an intuitive grasp that their consciousness is in their heart. Maybe you should explain your pointing game, because I think that, I mean, it's so simple, but it's so interesting, you know?
Yeah, it's a fascinating. Yeah, that pointing game comes from Swami Prabhupada, and when I present it in lectures, I get people point to the ceiling, point to the wall, point to your left foot, point to your right ear, and then I say point to yourself. And hardly anybody ever points to their heads. You know, if they did, it would even look peculiar. You can imagine pointing at your cerebral cortex. You know, it would be most peculiar. No one does. Hardly anyone. A few people do. You can often tell the types who think about it, and you can see their heaviness in their mind and their kind of thinking and point to their heads. But most people intuitively point to the heart area. So it's like our direct self-experience suggests our center of gravity of being is within the heart. And mystics would say that that's true, and that people have intuitive awareness of the self within the heart, even though we've lost remembrance of it. Yeah, the pointing game is very valuable. I think there's so many experiential and self-study elements that clearly prove the fallacy of the head doctrine. You know, like the other example you gave before, like If I put my hands together and see how large my hands are, they're about the same size. But if I concentrate my attention on one hand for 15 seconds, as I bring my attention to my hand, it engorges with blood, and after 15 seconds I put my hands together, and my right hand that I put my attention into is a quarter inch larger than my left hand. Now, how would a head doctrine theorist account for that. There's no conceivable way you could account for that within the head doctrine. Well, I mean, there might be. I don't know how. But.
Well, I mean, they just say it's, you know, your brain directing blood flow, but there you go. I mean,
but the brain has no way of directing, well... Yeah, I mean, they'd have to establish a mechanism, mechanism.
The critical thing is that blood flow is implicated, you know. And I mean, as we were talking about that before on a previous program, too, I mean, for the longest time, it was thought that it was an article of faith in modern science that really all these autonomic processes were, they were involuntary and you couldn't gain control over them. But that must have been a real shock to yogis in India controlling their heart rate and all sorts of different autonomic processes for thousands of years through the study of themselves and through various disciplines of yoga. And now we know through biofeedback that these things are, you know, eminently under control and are not involuntary. So, you know, that just goes to show you that, again, even our estimates of you know, the nature of our being and what's automatic and what's not are completely, you know, open to question. I mean, there's so much more that we can transform through systematic study of ourselves, and that we can know ourselves in quite dramatically different ways. The last show we talked briefly, we were talking about the metaphor of the biocomputer, and I was saying that I didn't really like that metaphor, and you said, well, you know, you thought it was really useful because in a lot of ways we are like computers, and we kind of talk back and forth, but I was thinking a little bit about what I meant to say then, and one of the things is that in a way I think, like, you know, when you talk about the normal mental functioning that goes on in our head brains, I think that, you know, that metaphor is apt, because I think a lot of it, you know, is like a computer, like it does function like a computer. But my objection to that is, first of all, the bio part, because it feels very tacked on to me, because I think, in my sense of it, I think it kind of reinforces the whole head doctrine. It's that, like, there's a computer in our brains and it's running everything. But the more basic objection I have to it is that a computer can't study itself and it can't transform itself. It can't transcend itself. So, you know, it's useful to a point, but I think it's a very limited metaphor in that sense. And as I say, I think it reinforces kind of the idea that I don't think people are talking about the computer in the heart and the computer in the spinal column. Although maybe they are, you know, like some people might. But there are functions that definitely operate. I'd say the lower aspect of each of our brains does operate like a computer. But beyond that, it's possible to transform things, and that a computer can't do, and that's where the metaphor breaks down. Like, I'd say it's sort of an interesting description of how we are, but it has no kind of room to allow for what we can become through self-study and self-transformation.
Yeah, I mean, there's different angles on the issue. I mean, I know in modern information theory, I mean, I read an article from Scientific American on kind of black hole physics and black hole computers. And the concept he says in there, he says everything is a computer, even a particle, because everything computes. What does a particle compute? It computes the laws of physics. Like, everything processes information. So in what he was trying to present in this kind of view of quantum information theory is everything is a computer, even particles, because they compute the mathematical laws of physics. So he's meaning it in that very broad way. Everything computes because everything processes information. So that's a broader kind of concept of what's meant by a computer.
Yeah,
but I can see at the same time what you're saying, where the analogy breaks down.
Yeah, I mean, but that's really interesting. So is this guy suggesting, like some theorists do, that, like, photons are conscious, like that all particles have a consciousness or like a mindfulness?
Well, no, no, but
or
he's suggesting all particles compute. They process information. Okay, because they calculate the laws of physics. Like particles are everything is processing information.
Wow.
So everything is computing.
Wow.
Yeah, it's in a very broad way. I'll come back to that. Next time I'll dig out that article on black hole computers in Scientific American.
Is that a reason?
So to me, I mean, I like to see the heart is like the basic quantum computer at the heart of being. So I see the heart as a quantum computer that exists within all these zero-point fields of the quantum vacuum. And those are all information fields. So the heart exists in this information fields, all latent within the quantum vacuum. Like, when from a mystical perspective, if we take Madame Blavatsky says that there's one omniscience that thrills throughout every finite point of the cosmos. So that suggests that all of space is permeated with this infinite intelligence, this omniscience. So any point in space somehow contains the information about the whole. It's like a completely holographic view.
Yeah. Wow.
Okay, so if we imagine that the heart exists within an information field which potentially contains information about the whole of the universe, so then the heart is like a quantum computer in this deep zero-point field.
Before you go any further, when you say the heart exists in this information field, are you talking about the physical heart or are you talking about the metaphysical heart?
Well, I would say all of them, any of them. I mean, I would say, space itself is an information field. Within what seems to be empty space, there's an omniscience throughout all of space. So there's this huge, vast reservoir of information latent everywhere within space itself. And we as living beings exist within space.
So try to amplify a little bit on the heart's connection to the subtle dimensions and how this through zero points. Like, I mean, because I think you're talking about something. I think there's another angle on this that you're not touching on. Like, I mean, do you understand what I'm kind of getting at? Like, because you're saying like consciousness manifests through a zero point, which is centered in the heart, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So,
I would say there's different levels to the heart, and my understanding here is based largely on Kabbalah, and in Kabbalah there are four world orders, worlds of emanation, which is a divine realm. So I would say the first level in the heart is a divine source emanation. Okay, that's like a God particle, a God spark, or a divine spark. The Sufis call it a divine spark. Okay, that's the world of emanation. Second world order is the world of creation. That's the spiritual world. So I would say there's a spiritual heart, which is stepped down from the divine world. You step down into the spiritual world. So I would say you have a spiritual self and a spiritual heart. And then you come down the world, emanation, creation, the formation. The world of formation is the psychical world. So I would say you have a psychical level to the heart. And the last world is the world made, which is the material heart. So I would say there's really divine source emanation, spiritual self within the heart, psychical heart, and then the physical heart. And they're interpenetrating. Okay, and it's through the higher dimensions of the heart are rooted into the zero-point fields. So each of those levels of the heart would have access to information of the corresponding level and would exist in zero-point fields. Like each of these world orders are zero-point fields at different levels. So these different levels of the heart are interconnected to these different levels of zero-point fields that permeate space. I don't know if that's bringing... answering what you're trying to get at.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at, because you're talking about the zero point fields, but I was trying to relate it to, you know, I mean most people would just think of the physical heart and that's what I was trying to get at. But also the higher the level would inform the lower level, which would inform the other level, the other next lower level, which inform eventually the material level. So in a sense, we on the material level, our heart on the material level is informed by three other successively higher levels of consciousness and energy or intelligence, right?
Yeah.
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 I mean, it's such an incredibly strange idea in a way, but it makes such incredibly good sense when you start to think of it from a whole variety of levels, like in terms of mystical teachings and esoteric teachings, but also in terms of modern science. I mean, how this could work, or you know, how this is plausible. I love that description that Blavatsky. It's just that word she uses that this omniscience thrills through every atom of creation. I think
every finite point of the
every universe. I mean, that's one of the most beautiful things I think I've ever heard in my life. I just, every time I hear that, I get a thrill when I hear it, you know. It's like it's such a profound vision of things, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe Richard Dawkins should read that.
Yeah. It's interesting also, like, it's totally consistent with the newest ideas in holographic physics. That everything is interrelated at these different information fields. Like if we think in quantum theory, any particles which leave a singlet state are phase entangled. Now if we think the whole universe emerged from a singularity point and then split and split and split again and again and again, but everything from the very beginning was interconnected in hard dimensional phase space. So everything is interconnected from the very first. So information about the whole really permeates every element, separate element within the whole. It's like David Bohm in physics. He said, we have to understand the nature of reality, we have to begin with the undivided wholeness of the whole of the universe. And then we regard any manifestations as differentiations out of that wholeness. But the wholeness is the fundamental reality. And that's what Blavatsky's saying. There's an omniscience. There's the information about everything in the universe present everywhere. So we exist within these information fields. Just to give one other example here that I find the... I read this article on black hole computers, and imagine beginning just the idea of a black hole. Imagine a universe, a material energetic system collapsing to a zero point source or down to a singularity, like a black hole. At the center of a black hole is said to be a singularity. So imagine a material energetic system collapsing down to Planckian levels. Now, in the new information theory, when you get down to Planckian levels, you can encode vast amounts of information down at very low Planckian levels. And there's an estimate in here, in the article in Scientific American, that as you collapse a material system down to zero-point levels, you can have 10 to the 40th bits of information encoded within a small... volume of space of Planckian units. Now, in science, if they imagine a system collapsing to a zero-point level, what happens as matter and energy disappears into a black hole, you have a loss of entropy. Okay, and the way in physics they compensate for this is that as the system collapses, information pours out. So as the material energetic system collapses to a point, information
there's an increase of information, and the increase of information balances the loss of entropy from the matter and energy disappearing into the black hole. You have the output of information. Now, I'm not explaining this well, but what I'm trying to get at is this analogy. The Dalai Lama says, as a person approaches death, consciousness and the vital energies gather again from the hands and the feet, and they all withdraw into the side channels, the Ida and Pingala, and then all the energies gather again at the heart. So it's like life grows from within without from the heart at the beginning of life, but at death, all the energies and consciousness withdraw into the heart. So you might imagine the heart being like a black hole. And all this vitality is kind of withdrawing into the higher dimensions of the heart. And as this happens, the Dalai Lama says, it induces manifestations of subtle mind. Okay? Or you might imagine it induces a life review. Everything that's happened to you in your life is kind of present before your eyes. Okay? Or you can re-experience everything that's happened to you. You have a life review. So what would a life review be? In a way, it's all the quantum field information of everything that's happened to you in your life, that it's still all present there at a certain level within the zero-point field. So as your consciousness withdraws into your heart functions analogously to a black hole computer. Okay, and so as the consciousness resolves into the heart, it resolves into these deep information fields, and you can remember everything that has happened to you through your life. I'm not sure this is coming across, but in a way, I would say the heart at death functions as a black hole computer. And that's how we have a past life review, is because everything that's ever happened to us through our life is still present in the information fields pervading space. Does that come across at all? I'd have to articulate it a little more clearly.
I'm sorry, did you say something?
But you get the idea.
Yeah,
of what
I know. I see the analogy. It's just so difficult to try to conceptualize. I mean, you know, I've kind of heard similar ideas expressed before about the life review, about that there's got to be some sort of field or some sort of way in which this information is always there, you know. I was listening to you, and I was thinking, well, I mean, if you're withdrawing, like the consciousness and life principle is withdrawing into the heart, and then there's some sort of experience of a subtle field, because it's not in the information isn't in the physical body. It can't be in the matter of the physical body, because the matter of the physical body is always changing. So, that fits in with it. That there has to be some sort of life field in which information is preserved, you know, because that's one of the anomalies of the whole material perspective, is like how do our bodies, which the actual matter is always changing, does it preserve form and memory and history of what's happened to it, because the actual, you know, physical atoms are changed, you know.
Like, yeah,
you know,
every atom, every molecule.
You know, every 180 days your skin changes completely. You don't have one atom of skin that you had 180 days ago.
That's a neat point, Jim. It's
an incredible point, and it's one that whenever people talk about the materials perspective, I'm always thinking, like, why doesn't anybody ever talk about that? Like, okay, for instance, I have a cut on, I have a scar on my arm that I got when I was 10 years old. Well, you know, that scar is still there, but those aren't the same atoms. There's some sort of intelligence that not only replenishes the material of my arm, the skin cells, but somehow it preserves the memory that, you know, that I have a scar there, of what's happened to me. You know, and at the same time, there's an aging process going on. So there's physical changes happening in the skin itself, you know, starting to sag and it's starting to loosen because I'm aging, you know. So there's like two different things going on. There's the history of my body, and then there's the actual changes that are occurring because of the aging process. I mean, it's incredible. But none of it is given by the actual cells, and it's not in your DNA either. It's somehow there's a field there that informs all this. So
yeah, it's like the memory field of the body.
Yeah, yeah.
And through many dimensions.
Yeah, and again, I would say that's an anomaly that really nobody talks about in terms of consciousness. But I mean, and see, that's in a way like, I mean, that's kind of the computer metaphor, eh? It's like that there's something computing all the time. I mean, I'm starting to kind of come around to liking the computer metaphor more, that there is like this kind of information field that's informing everything, you know?
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, things are changing, which is really interesting too, eh? Like, I mean, the whole aging process, you know, like is so interesting. So, yeah, I. But your analogy to the black hole is very interesting. I mean, it's very much... I can see that, you know, that how that would be possible.
Yeah, I'll try to explain it another time, articulate it a little bit more clearly, and I'll get the references. I'll dig out my Scientific American article on black hole computers, and I'll explain it a little bit more carefully next time. But let me just quote these lyrics. I love these lyrics. They're from a song by Papa Roach, which is a heavy metal band. I really like some of Papa Roach's music. And they have one song called Between Angels and Insects, which is neat, eh? Because,
yeah,
like, human beings, we're kind of between angels and insects.
Yeah.
And this is what some of the lyrics to the... tell them what you heard. It's about a revolution in your heart and in your mind. Because everything is nothing... Okay, and emptiness is in everything.
Wow.
This reality is just a fucked up dream.
Wow.
With the flesh and the blood that you call your soul, flip it inside out, it's a big black hole. Papa Roach sings that.
This is a heavy metal band?
Yeah. It's a wild song. I love it. Yeah, so just... Because everything is nothing, and emptiness is in everything, and the flesh and the blood that you call your soul, flip it inside out, it's a big black hole.
Wow.
So this is what I'm saying. I'm saying there is a big black hole, except it's a mini black hole, at the heart of being. And that at death, our consciousness withdraws down into this mini black hole. And this functions then, as it does that, then the information latent within the zero-point fields become available to that consciousness.
Wow.
So, yeah. But the whole science of the heart, it's so complex. Like in my book on the heart doctrine, I have that chapter on the science of yoga. And the fellow there, he explains how there's these different sheaths surrounding the jiva atma within the heart. And he goes through what the different sheaths are. And in a way, you can think of these as different levels of the ethers. So it's like the jiva atma is within these different levels of the ether, and each level of the ether has information corresponding to that level of vibratory creation. So as consciousness withdraws into the heart, the information becomes available.
What do you mean by ethers? Like, is that like subtle?
Well, it's like, see...
Subtle levels? Or
The way I argue human, what we are as beings, I say a human being has a triune monadic essence established in seven-dimensional hyperspace. Okay, so that we have a triune monad connected to higher dimensions of the heart, and it's established in seven-dimensional hyperspace.
Everybody says that, Chris.
So again, everybody says that, yeah. So now, this, I would say also you have this monadic essence, and it's like in my writing, I compare it to the Calabi-Yau spaces in 11-dimensional models of the universe, where they, because in physics now, they think that every point in four-dimensional space-time, at every point, there is a seven-dimensional hypersphere. They're called Calabi-Yau spaces. Okay, so I'm actually suggesting a human being has such a little Calabi-Yau space at the heart of being. Okay, now, what I'm also suggesting, this little monadic essence, I think it has spin properties, spinergy. Because, see, for Blavatsky, everything in creation is a modification of the ceaseless eternal breath. Everything is in motion. There's nothing that is still. Everything is in vibratory motion. So this monadic essence, I would say, has spin properties. It's a complex little element in seven-dimensional hyperspace. And it has all these spin properties. And I'm saying that the spin properties of the monadic essence, what that does, that spin energy helps to materialize particles out of the quantum vacuum surrounding the central point. So at the heart of being is this emptiness, and around that you have bodies that crystallize out of the quantum vacuum surrounding that central point. So the person is then clothed in seven different bodies, all surrounding a central vacated space. And you have your monadic essence in this vacated space. So it's that type of concept that I'm trying to look at as a basis for the human being a holographic system.
Now, what would you... the only thing that... I kind of followed that, but... what is the nature of the monadic essence? You're saying it has spin properties, but what do you mean by a monadic essence?
You could call it different things. I mean, you could call it a divine source emanation, a divine spark,
yeah.
A God spark. You could call it, but it's like it's an entity. It's a little monadic essence. It's like a point particle, but it's established in seven-dimensional hyperspace. It's too hard to explain some of these concepts here, but you know, in some of my writings on the holographic physics, it's the idea is that you might have an element in a higher dimensional anti-Sittler space, it's so hard to explain this. I'm not used to trying to explain this. But there's an equivalency of physics. You might have a monadic essence in hyperspace, and the physics of that is equivalent to the physics that you would see manifest on different planes of existence. There's an equivalency. What might have manifest as material matter on one level, on a higher dimensional level, it could correspond to the spin properties of this monadic essence in higher dimensions. I'm not explaining this well. It's like Blavatsky says, material points without extension, zero points, are the materials by which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies.
Yeah.
So I'm suggesting that there's this kind of zero-point center to a human being, and there's a monadic essence in there. It's like a divine spark, and it has certain spin properties, and its spin properties... What that does is it breaks the symmetries in the quantum vacuum surrounding it, so it materializes matter surrounding a central point.
Right.
So a person is brought down through successive planes of being through forming these different bodies into the physical.
I wanted to ask you, whenever you bring up this Blavatsky quote, does she think that trees and, you know, animals and when she says, you know, that they clothe themselves, do they clothe themselves as all sorts of different things, or is she talking strictly about human beings?
Any living cosmos.
Okay.
So in this view, the whole universe itself has a zero-point origin, which modern science agrees it does.
So everything...
Okay, but any living being, you know, insects, animals, any living cosmos, a sun, an earth.
Wow.
Like Blavatsky says, the sun has a zero-point center.
Okay.
Okay. See, you know how scientists think that they're searching for the dark matter in the universe?
Yeah.
One of the reasons they're searching for the dark matter is because if you look out at galaxies, and the spinning, rotating galaxies, there's not enough mass in the galaxy to hold it together by gravitational attraction in
right.
the form that it is. So they think there has to be dark matter that is forming it as a galaxy, okay? But what they don't conceive is that there is a zero-point center and that things have grown from a zero-point center. So it's not simply mass or matter that holds the galaxy together. No, the galaxy has grown from a center.
Hmm.
You see what I don't know if that's coming across.
Well,
as I'm trying to explain.
I see what you're saying. So it's kind of manifesting out of the zero-point center.
Yeah.
Yeah, rather
yeah,
than...
Yeah, so you don't have to see, like... Yeah, scientists, another example, like scientists wonder, is there enough matter in the universe now to collapse the universe, okay? And they think that if the period of universal expansion is to turn into a period of universal contraction back to a zero point, okay? So they're searching for the dark matter that will close the universe.
Right.
Okay, well, from my reading of the Secret Doctrine and other esoteric teachings, what will close the universe isn't the presence of matter. It instead will be a movement induced in hyperspace that will collapse the universe. See, the scientist thinks the universe would collapse due to just the presence of blind matter.
Right.
But Blavatsky says the universe expands when the breath of the Father is upon it. So it expands. And then she says, when the breath of the mother ingathers the universe, then.
Right.
So the divine mother is hyperspace itself.
Wow. Okay.
So it's a movement in hyperspace that will then draw the universe back to its zero-point origin.
So she's kind of presenting an oscillating universe model?
Yeah, Blavatsky, yeah, it's an oscillating universe. In the beginning, according to Blavatsky, there's seven nights of Brahma, where all of creation is absorbed into non-being, seeming non-being. And then creation lasts for 7 days of Brahma before, so it expands within without from zero points, eventually withdraws without within back to a zero point, back into the nothingness. And Blavatsky says this goes on infinitely.
Wow.
So it's her model is of an oscillating universe growing from zero-point sources and eventually withdrawing back into zero-point sources endlessly. I mean, it was amazing that she argued this in 1888. I mean, it's remarkable because now in modern science, physicists have the same concepts. They do think that our universe might collapse to a black hole and eventually to a singularity. That's a modern concept now, but Blavatsky was arguing that 100 years ago.
Have you ever, well, actually 125 years ago.
Yeah.
But have you ever read, I know that Einstein kept a copy of The Secret Doctrine on his bed table, eh? But have you ever read anything that suggests that he was influenced by Blavatsky's ideas at all?
No, I've heard this, that he always had a copy of The Secret Doctrine. That's supposedly reported by his niece, who made that statement to someone. But I see no influence of The Secret Doctrine teachings on Einstein's thought. No,
yeah.
I don't see that at all. Because, I mean, even You know, Einstein postulated this cosmological constant because he thought the universe was neither expanding nor contracting, but
right.
in a stable state, eh?
Right.
But Blavatsky was completely the opposite.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't, although I've heard Einstein was supposed to treasure his copy of The Secret Doctrine, I see no influence of its percepts on his own work.
Yeah.
There might be another aspects, perhaps.
See, listening to this, and this is kind of, you know, one of the things that I want to address. I'm writing a book called The Problem of God's Contracting Universe, in which I'm going to describe your work as a response to Carl Sagan's comment some 30 years ago when he said, it seems that, you know, as science comes to more and more natural explanations of things, and there's less need for to invoke supernatural forces or causes to explain things. And he says, it seems that as science advances, there's less and less for God to do. And that's what you called the problem of God's contracting universe. And really, your work for the past 30 years has been a reply to that. I that's the way I see it. I see
yes, it has. Yeah.
This is your formulation based on mystical and esoteric teachings, presented in terms of a dialogue with modern scientific and psychological ideas. And when I read Carl Sagan, and he says, you know, I was really struck by that when he said that, you know, it seems to him that the religious teachings are too provincial and too local. And, you know, and I'm thinking, well, I know he doesn't know about the mystical esoteric teachings because he never really discusses them, and he just kind of, he uses mysticism, as many scientists do, as a pejorative term for that which is unsubstantiated which can't be communicated. But it's amazing, again, you know, the lack of awareness of these profound ideas that exist in the mystical and esoteric traditions. And I mean, I think Paramahansa Yogananda's autobiography, when he describes his experience of cosmic consciousness it's hardly provincial. I mean, when he starts talking about how his consciousness expands and expands, and so he's aware of everything in space, and then he expands into space, and he actually sees world orders being created out of fire and crystallizing, and he sees that the universe is a sea of light, and he's aware of everything is being composed of tissues, of actual materialities composed of tissues of light. And I'm thinking, that doesn't sound too provincial or local to me.
No.
I mean, sounds pretty cosmic to me, you know. Carl Sagan had a book, The Cosmic Connection, you know. Well, Yogananda had a cosmic connection experience, you know. I mean, he knew it directly. And if it was one guy, you'd say, well, he's making it up or it's poetry. But there's literally thousands of such accounts from both people who have studied themselves systematically and tried to develop consciousness, and people who have had spontaneous experiences of what's called cosmic consciousness, you know. It's amazing that it's a shame. I mean, it's a credit to you that you've taken this material seriously and you've tried to understand it, but it's amazing that in modern education and in modern thinking, that this isn't part of kind of our cultural inheritance, you know, that we don't we can all sing the theme to Gilligan's Island, but we don't know about this, you know. I mean, there's something seriously wrong here.
I mean, I don't know the year that Autobiography of a Yogi was published. Do you know the year? That must have been back in 1940s, 50s.
I think it was perhaps in the. I think he came to Los Angeles in the 30s, but might be like 1940s or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite remarkable because in that chapter, Yogananda is really explaining a holographic model of consciousness.
Yeah, that's
back then, because, like you say, his consciousness expands into the universe, and it's like his being blends with the whole universal structure. The end of his experience, he kind of comes back into his body, and he says he realized that from a point of intuitive perception within his heart, irradiated splendor into the whole universal structure.
Yeah.
So he actually says at the end of that experience of his,
he says it was a point of intuitive perception in his heart was somehow interconnected to the whole vastness of the universe he had experienced.
Yeah.
And in a way, it's it's astonishing kind of confirmation of the holographic idea.
Yeah, and
that was well before modern holographic ideas, modern theories about holographs.
And there again, you know, everybody's heard the expression that, that mystics claim to experience themselves as being at one with the universe, but they don't realize.
I have to ask a question.
Two with one another, sorry.
Do you mind if I ask a question?
Yeah.
You know, having Dr. Holmes on BBS Radio and yourself included, I'm always enwrapped, totally, completely engrossed. I mean, what you guys are talking about is exactly the type of information I go over, and you're coming to the same conclusions that I come to. And in a different way, but
yeah.
a very similar. And boy, I'd love to discuss some of them with you because it would be an amazing day-long discussion. It would be just, needless to say. because I really would look forward to that. How do you feel about knowing what you know? How does that tie in now to a hierarchy?
To a hierarchy?
To a hierarchy, exactly. A spiritual hierarchy. How would that tie into your theory, and do you believe there is one? Again, like, let's say people talk about archangels, Metatron,
yeah.
This, angels, and the whole bit. And some say the Ra, and some say group energies, the Council of the Elohim, and the creators. How does all that hierarchy fit in to your model of emanation, creation, and then it goes to cyclical, right?
Yeah.
And then to physical manifestation. But
yeah.
And again, I believe that's quite accurate.
Yeah.
And I could go into all my reasons as to why, but yeah.
Well,
I'll let you answer that, and I'll get off.
And
thank you. Thank you.
Stay on with us, Don, and like just to respond to that, I believe in a hierarchy, and that there are beings on all of these different levels, archangels, angels. Like there's a whole hierarchy of intelligences that inform the laws of science and inform all living beings. So Blavatsky says before creation happens, there's seven luminous suns which are latent in non-being. So there's seven divine beings in latent in nothingness. And then when creation happens, she says seven inside, seven outside. So the first created are the seven Elohim, the seven spiritual intelligences. So I would see there's a whole hierarchy of intelligences. There's seven levels to the spiritual world, seven levels
yes,
to the divine
exactly,
world, to the psychical world,
exactly,
and the physical world.
Exactly.
And there are hierarchies of beings on all of these levels.
Yes.
And we ourselves can attain to higher levels. I think we have to crystallize elements in our higher being bodies so we can experience on these more subtle planes.
I agree. And I agree with you thinking that the information does work similar to a mini black hole that is really in the heart center of each of us. And it makes sense almost when you think of, and this is going to be a mind blower, but you could take all of physical reality and state that it is actually in a black hole.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is one black hole, and you're just seeing instantaneousness slow itself down, and you're seeing that in such a way as really it's already happened. It's always was. It's all the past, present, the now is one, and that interconnectivity. So you really, in one essence, are totally in a black hole, and you're seeing things late.
Yeah. Yeah, it exists the whole time.
It's like a continuum of eyes.
Sorry?
It's like the continuum of the eyes. You know,
yeah.
It's from one, from the mini to the maxi. You see what I mean?
The way the universe begins from a singularity, we can imagine that, and we might imagine it collapsing to a singularity at the end of time. But I would say the singularity isn't only present at the beginning and at the end. It's there all the time.
Correct. Correct.
The whole
exactly.
Thing is
exactly.
At the whole.
Yes.
Is we move through it in seemingly successive moments.
Well, it's
but the whole structure exists at once. So the whole thing.
Well, it has to. It has to, because one and two, if you have the number one and the number two, like you were talking about earlier, the two is not separate from the one. It contains the one. And three contains the one, and four contains the one. But interestingly enough, three also contains the two, which contains the one. And the two contains the one, which contains the one. So that's how it replicates, and it is mathematically sound. To think such.
Yeah. It actually follows, like, the idea of the wholeness and interrelatedness of everything
fractal,
in the universe.
Sure, quantum.
Is a natural consequence of quantum theory.
Certainly.
I mean, that's why Einstein objected to quantum theory. He couldn't believe what he called the baffling holism.
Right.
Yeah. But
exactly.
So in mysticism, in a way, it's completely consistent with quantum theory.
Yeah, well,
because
yeah.
Quantum theory has everything is interrelated in higher dimensional space.
Exactly. And when you try to cut that aspect out of your science, you get what we have today, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But now they're coming back around because, again, this is really not too new. It's just new to everybody because they've been brainwashing everybody for so long.
It's funny. I almost see it as an intentional effort in modern times.
To dumb down the people.
To denigrate religion.
Sure.
To deny soul and spirit in human beings and in nature.
Yeah.
And it's like, I see it as part of this.
It's almost when they signed the Federal Reserve Act, isn't it? It's almost like when you gave the bankers the power, they started to use it. And this country has fallen significantly.
I'm sorrowful for American society.
It's pitiful, isn't it? It's pitiful.
It's unbelievable what's happened in American society.
And we're allowing
such
it.
Such high ideals and nobility and beauty and such, and then what's become of America.
Yeah.
I just hope you as Americans can reclaim your country.
We will. In fact, that has begun. And it is a movement that cannot stop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to hear something very interesting, a little figure for you? In the time that we've been on the air... the American government has spent almost $20 million in Iraq in the last 2 hours. It's $237 million a day.
It's mind-blowing.
Jesus, we could just go around and bribe everybody not to
yeah.
I mean, for that price, I mean, you know, like, I mean, $37 billion a month.
It's horrible.
I mean, you know, the figures defy imagination, and the national debt
well, the figures
over
have been,
$9 trillion now. So.
Well, the
yeah.
figures have been, you know, they're baseless. We all know this. I mean, they just, money is totally baseless.
Yeah.
They just create what they need when they need it, and they'll take the rest anyways.
Yeah. I mean, I think particularly at this time, I see us as being at a very critical time in the history of humanity between now and 2012. I mean, it seems to me at the moment we're in real danger of the U.S. initiating a war with Iran, and it's like Bush has only got a certain period of time left, and he's just so headstrong. He just won't listen to anyone. He's got his agenda, and, you know, we see the American Navy now and nuclear weapons in the Persian Gulf, and I'm just very worried that nothing's going to be done in Congress to begin to restrain the man.
You know what's going to happen if this is allowed? You got to remember that Congress right now realizes that if this is allowed to go ahead, it's going to create such a stink. They won't even have a chance to build their power base back. I don't think the Democrats are willing to take that kind of a chance, considering the upcoming elections and every. It's still a political game. Even the financial system. I mean, the reason we have up and down economies is because it's manipulated from A to Z, and you're going to continue to. People are going to be frightened and go run to the bank, and economies are. But it's so manipulated that they could collapse it tomorrow or keep it alive tomorrow.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, we're so manipulated. People haven't even begun to realize it.
No. No, people have no idea. I mean, to me, what stuns me the most is that the truth of 9/11. I mean, this whole myth of what 9/11 was supposed to be and what it really was, and yet no major media report.
Well, that's 9/11. Because the major media folks. I mean, hey, look at Murdoch. I mean, folks, Rupert. I don't. You know, I love everybody. I even love him too. Let's leave it at that. But you know, it's the media that we have and the way they tie in with some of these bankers and really the corrupt petty thieves that are intrinsic in the mafia, whether they be the Red Mafia and so on, that have really built an underground worldwide organization that have taken over, and there are a few heads of it, and they're the heads of the cartels and the drug cartels and so on.
That's exactly what it is, underground worldwide organization.
Correct. Yeah. And they're competing now with the handlers. And the handlers, of course, are the people with the big, big money, and they're the main bankers. And it's all just a big rip-off scam. And a lot of fun, I guess. It's a shame. People, we have the opportunity now to change it.
Yeah. Yeah, it, to me, in a way, that's the one thing about 9/11 is in that event is your evidence of this very deep, dark, sinister element that's been underlying known history through.
Well, the truth of that will bring out all those underlying unknown elements.
Exactly.
And so it's kind of like a little breath of the truth that hit everybody.
Yeah.
And it will continue to grow.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope so. I trying to contribute as I can.
I love you. I'm going to. I thank you for letting me out, be on the air with you guys. Really fabulous.
Oh, it's nice to have you on.
Yeah.
It's nice to know somebody's listening to
you. Oh. Well, thank you.
Well, that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, it was nice done. Join
yeah.
us. Sir.
Yeah.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, well...
isn't it a crazy world situation at the moment, eh, Jim?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, I was going to mention last time we were on, I think I kind of owe you an apology because... you were saying that you thought that Bush was going to attack Iran, and I said I just didn't see how he could do it because I was seeing it politically. But I mean, he's such a, you know. Well, I see it. It's a very real possibility. I don't like the rhetoric that's coming out. And,
no.
There was an article by Seymour Hersh in the New Yorker at the end of December, which I hadn't read yet, about you know the possibility of this happening. I mean, I'd heard about this before, but I just figured like what Don just said. I just didn't think he'd have the political capital to do it, but these guys are so completely deluded and so untrustworthy and so sinister that I wouldn't put anything past them, you know.
No.
Although
no,
having
I wouldn't.
Said all that, I just don't see, because I was reading a thing today where it said that one of the military analysts said, well, you just can't just bomb Iran, that you know, you're going to have to put troops on the ground, and they just don't have them. I mean, it's that simple. They don't have that. They're spread too thin already in Iraq, you know.
Well, but that, I thought that was the point, is I don't think they need ground troops
Iran.
That's not part of it.
But they're saying that they do. But then, too, you know, you start reading about, this is the world we live in. You start reading about where the nuclear program is in Iran.
Yeah.
And you get all sorts of different information, and you know you have CIA analyzing data, and you have the International Association for Atomic Energy, and you have all these different reports, and the same kind of Orwellian newspeak comes out where people are pointing at the fact that because there isn't evidence that they have an advanced nuclear program, that's evidence that they do have an advanced nuclear program. I'm thinking, like, you know, talk about down the friggin' rabbit hole, eh? I mean, these guys are just, like, they're so pathetic,
yeah.
You know? I mean, and, you know, I mean, it's not just the big lies. It's the consistent just normal lies that really annoy me is that people keep talking about, you know, that the United States went to a war in Iraq because of faulty intelligence. And I mean, give me a break. They lied from day one. They wanted to go to war from day one before 9/11. Read a little history. It's all there. I mean, they consistently rejected any notion that Saddam didn't have weapons of mass destruction. But even if he did, what gives them the right to go and attack him? I mean, to attack a country, you know, in Iraq. The whole thing is just completely bizarre, you know. It's
a nightmare.
It's a complete and utter nightmare. Like I say, you know, $237 million a day to fight in Iraq. I mean, you know, how about spending $237 million in the inner city of every city in the United States, you know? How about spending $237 million a day on health care? I mean, what a complete and utter joke, you know. They should be taken out and hung from the nearest lamppost. You know?
Why would you
say
that?
What's that?
I wouldn't like to see that. I don't.
That was metaphorical.
I know.
And please don't arrest me, you know.
I don't want a vacation
in Cuba, you know. I'm nonviolent. I don't believe that in any kind of violence.
Capital punishment.
I don't believe in violence solving problems.
No, me neither.
You know? Completely idiotic, you know.
No, it's got to be a change of heart. That's how I see it. It's like it has to be an awakening of consciousness and awakening of the heart. And if we can see what we've done, we'd experience a deep remorse of conscience. I mean, I believe in Americans are fine people and such noble ideals. They'd be horrified if they really understood all the deviousness of what's been done in their name as America. It's terrible. That's not what Americans want.
No, I agree.
You know?
By the way...
Nor Israelis, you know, and the same thing in Israel. I mean, you know one thing just to say about the Iran situation? What shocks me is how can the Americans say that they may bomb or destroy part of a country who might develop a nuclear weapon when they themselves have the most massive nuclear arsenal on the planet, and they've got all kinds of nuclear weapons over in the theater there. How can they point to someone else and say they might have a bomb? You know, like, who's to talk?
I know. Well, that's
you know, it's just complete doublethink.
Yeah, it's hypocrisy, and it's just completely, you know, intolerable. Yeah. By the way, Autobiography of a Yogi was written in 1946. And, you know, just to return one thing, as I was going to say, because this kind of ties back into what we were talking about earlier. It's like, it's interesting you say, like, you know, really the holographic model is there and the heart doctrine is there, when he talks about an intuitive...
A point of intuitive perception.
A point of intuitive perception in his heart.
Yeah.
And he sort of knows... He knows himself as being at one with the universal structure, you know. And I mean, as you say, somebody like Carl Sagan or Richard Dawkins would be able to, you know, quote that, you know, mystics have claimed to be at one with the universe, but they don't realize the profound, you know, it's easy to say that. They think it's kind of poetic, but they don't want to look farther. They don't want to look beyond a superficial understanding of that and try to understand, well, what do people mean when they say that they're one with the universe, you know?
I don't think they even consider it that might be serious.
That's the horror of it all, you know, is that, I mean, really, you know, when it comes to teaching religion in schools, I mean, maybe we should just teach, you know, Yogananda's experience in psychology class too, you know, because really, if you really look at it, it just makes a mockery of, I would say, of what modern psychology is and what it professes to understand. I think, you know, that just that one experience is so profound, it has such implications for things, you know?
Yeah, it does.
It's quite astonishing, and as you know, in your work in trying to elucidate what he's saying, it's just that much more powerful. The more you study it, the more you understand. You understand the implications of it. It has implications for the whole idea of non-locality and the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox. I mean, it's an extraordinary piece of writing and should be taught to everybody. You know?
Yeah, I've never come across such a profound description of cosmic consciousness as that example of Yogananda and anything I've ever read in the mystical literature.
No,
I've never come across anything comparable to that. I had a student bring that quote to my attention when I was back a professor. I'd read the book and I hadn't grasped that.
What?
And then she came and she kind of went into it with me and like asked about it. And it just the more I comprehended it, it's awesome. Awesome.
Yeah.
It's funny. I find now more and more in my own inner awareness of being, it's funny how much my inner sense of self has changed. How much now I feel myself spatially as extended around myself and as being empty.
Wow.
It's like empty. In the Dalai Lama says emptiness is like in everything. Everything is basically nothing, kind of.
Yeah.
You know. And so much now I have my inner self experience. I could feel like if a ton of lead dropped on my body, I would just continue to be here.
Mm. Don't try that, but
but it's like I feel a lot. I've lost my fear of death because I have this higher kind of dimensional experience of what I am.
Wow.
And now, like, I don't feel as connected simply to my material body as I used to. I have a deep sense, like, when I talk about these things, zero-point fields and higher dimensions and such, I more and more experience myself in those ways.
Hmm.
But anyway, okay, I noticed we're coming up. We've got 5 minutes left. Okay, so we're winding up. That was another two-hour session of Zero Point Radio. I'd like to thank James Moffat. James, have a good week. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
Yeah, and thanks to Don for coming on and to BBS Radio.
Yeah, and we hope we haven't. We'll try to come back to a few of the subjects we've talked about today, but it does take a time to comprehend what we're teaching and to consider.
Yeah.
Invite people to visit my website, zeropoint.ca. We thank, once again, BBS Radio, and there's lots of material up on the archives. Thanks, Don and Doug, and I'll be back in 2 weeks. Remember yourself. Try to wake up. We're in very dire times on this planet. We need to make extra efforts to awaken, to open our hearts, and to have our minds illuminated, and to gain a broader comprehension of what's happening in our society. Okay, love to you all. Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Don, Doug. Goodbye.
Thanks.